Hey, what's up, everyone? I'm Dr. Miriam Korick, and I've teamed up with Optometry Times to bring to you a new podcast called the You and I Podcast. We're going to be going over updates, research studies, latest up-and-coming technology in our field, and I'll also be interviewing expert guests in future episodes. Hey, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the You and I Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Miriam Korick, and today's discussion and guest interview is a really special one because it ties into a topic which I love, and that is the many different career paths that we as optometrists can take and what those paths can lead to, such as direct involvement in research that can really affect how we look at a disease and change how we practice for the better. So before I give too many hints away about the episode, I would like to introduce today's guest, Dr. Andy Morgenstern. Dr. Morgenstern is the president and co-founder of the International Keratoconus Academy and currently practices at the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. So welcome, Dr. Morgenstern, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, but you have to call me Andy for the rest of the podcast, if that's okay.
That's totally fine. I'll call you Andy.
All right. So, yeah, I just want to say thanks for having me on here. I know we're going to get started in a second, but I just want to say how this whole podcast came about is quite fortuitous. You know, I think it's really important, and hopefully we'll get into it, that we met obviously through colleagues and stuff like that over, you know, we've chatted and stuff, but really I didn't get to talk until we met at a meeting and really at an industry dinner. And you know, that time together, really just kind of hashing out work and what you're doing with the podcast. It was a great session. And I can't tell you how important that type of stuff is to the stuff that you're talking about on your podcast in terms of people doing unusual, new, different types of stuff in optometry. I think it's really important that we always get back to, you know, the socialization with our own colleagues in the profession. So thanks for having me on. It was quite fortuitous how we got here, but we're here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And yeah, I just love to educate other ODs, students about the different career paths and what we could possibly do with the degree. So like you've mentioned, we've met and talked before, but for those listening, can you please introduce yourself and just let us know what you're currently most passionate about in optometry?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm an optometrist. I work and live in Bethesda, Maryland, currently working at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center, where I do a combination of things. You know, you talk about the new and interesting and different type of stuff. You know, my career is part clinical and part research. I get to interact with both optometry and ophthalmology every single day, but I also have to interact with technicians and anybody that really touches eye care. So it's a pretty unique experience. In addition to that, I'm also the director for the American Optometric Association's evidence-based clinical practice guidelines. And, you know, I will, since I have the floor for, you know, a few minutes here, I will really try to make everybody go to that website at the AOA and go to our evidence-based clinical practice guidelines to download some of them. We've got an amazing committee of people that works on this. It's chaired by Carl Urbanski. He's an optometrist out of Pennsylvania. Each guideline takes about 2 years to complete. They are really the strongest evidence-based documents that we have in the profession of optometry, and they're free and available for everybody in the profession. And so you can go to AOA.org and go to the evidence-based clinical practice guideline section and download them for free. And when I'm not doing that stuff, I'm also the president of a professional society, and it's called the International Keratoconus Academy over here, of eye care professionals. And I formed it with Barry Iden and a few other folks. He's an optometrist in Chicago about 11 years ago. And really what we saw at the time was technology that was actually advancing faster than education was in schools and in the professional world, in the clinical world. And so we wanted to put together a not-for-profit educational society that really helped to educate people on the topic of keratoconus, because we knew back then in 2000, and we knew about it way back in the early 2000s, that the prevalence of the disease was much higher than it was being taught at. And so we wanted to make a difference because there were so many patients that were suffering out there. And so that led us to where we are today, which I'm sure we'll get into in the podcast.
Right. Actually, since you brought it up, IKA, When did it start? When did you found it? And how do other optometrists and students become members? How do we get involved?
Yeah. So number one, it's completely free to become a member. We have a website, keratoconusacademy.org. Barry and I founded it in 2000. Really, the idea started about, you know, well before 2013, but that's when we really put the paperwork together to form a corporation. One of the things that I want to stress is that, getting back to the theme of the podcast, which is like different stuff that's going on, I was working at TLC Laser Eye. I got my first Pentacam device in 2005, and we started seeing so many keratoconus because we were, you know, seeing the backside of the cornea for the first time back then. And we were learning so much about how the cornea functions and the disease. Prior to that, all we had was a corneal topographer. We only looked at the front surface curvature of the cornea. We never looked at, you know, the global thickness of the cornea. We never looked at the back surface elevation. We didn't have the capabilities of doing it. So we started finding keratoconus in the population that were coming in at a way higher prevalence rate. And so we had to educate people, because cross-linking was approved in every European Union country by 2006. We didn't get FDA approval here until 2016. And so there was a 10-year gap. We knew what was coming over from Europe. We knew all this stuff was going on. We just didn't have FDA approvals on it. A little bit of the Wild West and cross-linking back then here in the United States, because everybody was off-label. But the reality is that we knew this whole thing was changing. And so we saw an opportunity. It wasn't an opportunity to make money. It was an opportunity to educate. And so what we thought was the right thing to do, and, you know, both Barry and I were at a point in our careers where, you know, giving back at this point was really important. And so we literally saw an opportunity, and we founded the IKA to promote the education and knowledge base in keratoconus. And we didn't want it to be just an optometric organization. We really wanted it to be both optometric, ophthalmologic, and really, you know, any eye care provider, whether it's a technician or anybody that interacts with a patient, because these people are suffering. And, you know, just like any other eye disease, your eyeball doesn't know what doctor is in front of them. The eyeball just knows it wants to get better. And so it was important for us, because keratoconus is really a full scope optometric, ophthalmologic continuum of care disease, to educate everybody on this disease and bring that level of knowledge up as much as possible. And I think we've done a pretty good job. We're trying to be the loudspeaker of all the new stuff that's going on in keratoconus. But I can't stress to the audience enough, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And it very much so is within the profession of optometry. And we saw a need to help educate the masses. And so we went out and did what we had to do, which was figure it out from nothing, you know. And I think that's a pretty common theme with a lot of the folks that have been on your podcast, or the people that will be on your podcast, is a lot of these folks saw an opportunity and really didn't know what the right way to advance on it was, but they worked hard and they got to where they needed to.
Right. They saw a gap in the industry and they needed to fill it. Just how you saw, okay, collagen cross-linking has been around since 2006 in Europe, but in 2013, when you founded IKA, it wasn't here in the US yet. So education and promoting it and showing people why this is important was the gap that you needed to fill. I also just wanted to clarify for everyone listening, because you mentioned the Pentacam. So that's tomography, which basically shows you the posterior curvature of the cornea. Meanwhile, topography only maps the anterior surface. So would you say that you see changes in the posterior curvature before you see anterior and before reduced visual acuity?
Yeah, totally. 100%. You know, you're right on the money. There is a terminology difference, and the terminology difference is pretty big. You know, over the course of my career, and you'll see the same, and any, you know, people on the podcast see the same, that the profession changes so dramatically over the course of your career, because we're such a technologically dependent profession. You know, I lecture to people, and I was taught by people that were practicing in optometry that, you know, in the 1980s and really the early 1990s, the corneal topographer was not commercially available. corneal topographers really became commercially available in the very early 1990s. And so, you know, it's not that long ago. You know, it certainly wasn't when I started my career, but, you know, a lot of the people that taught me existed in a world fitting contact lenses without a corneal topographer. The corneal topographer measures, like you said, the front surface curvature. The corneal tomographer uses a Scheimpflug camera, which is a rotating camera, and it can actually bounce off the front surface and the back surface of the cornea to measure not the curvature, but really the elevation of the cornea. And when we do that, when we can measure two surface elevations, we can measure thickness. And it gives us just a much broader understanding of the cornea, really what's happening. To answer your question, yes, keratoconus is a disease that starts out on the posterior surface of the cornea. And really what I teach my students here and what I try to lecture on is that keratoconus is a disease of weak collagen. And so that weak collagen just does not have the durability to hold the cornea in place. And when you combine that with normal intraocular pressure that's pushing on the back surface of the cornea forward, it's going to push that whole cornea forward, make it start to bulge. And because keratoconus is a disease of weak collagen, we can either strengthen that collagen with corneal cross-linking, or we can make it worse by doing things like eye rubbing and doing refractive surgery on it. So, you know, understanding the anatomy of the cornea and the physiology of how it moves and all that stuff was really, once we got that Pennacam, those Scheimpflug cameras, it really gave us a whole different picture of what we can see with this anatomical structure, and then also how we understand a disease. And that's really the genesis of IKA and why we needed to educate so much.
Right, because the Pentacam essentially gave you a 3D model of it, if it's posterior, anterior, and the thickness of the cornea. Right. And right. Also, I like how you said that in the 1980s and 90s, a lot has changed about how we diagnose and how we practice. So this is really important for prevalence, because if a clinician thinks that a particular disease is super, super rare, the way they're looking for it, the way they're testing for it is different than if it's actually more prevalent than we previously thought.
100%. You know, and I do want to say for the record, I don't work for Oculus. I'm not taking a penny from Oculus in terms of, you know, promoting their device, the Pentacam. It just happens to be my favorite piece of equipment in the office because of what I do and what I'm passionate about. And it's really the best at what it does. That's on the market right there. I just want to kind of put that disclosure out. But you're 100% right. And, you know, to obviously with the prevalence of keratoconus, that's tremendously important. We're hosting an in-person and online conference coming up soon, the IKA Keratoconus Symposium. It's May 18th and 19th, 2024, here in Bethesda, Maryland, ironically. But what we love to talk about is why research is so important. Why is this data so important to us? And the answer is that when we learn about prevalence of a disease, it helps us as clinicians know what odds ratios there are of a certain patient walking in with a certain chance of having a disease. One of the parallels that we always like to draw is between glaucoma and keratoconus, especially in the pediatric population. And the reason why I say that is, and I always say this in my lectures, if you've ever been to one of my lectures on keratoconus, I say the same thing every time. Raise your hand if you do eye exams on kids. Well, everybody raises their hand. So raise your hand if you do, if you check an eye pressure on all your kids, and everybody raises their hand. And then I ask the question of all the kids that you have ever seen in your entire career that are otherwise relatively healthy, how many times have you diagnosed pediatric glaucoma? And the answer is, in the rooms that I have, maybe 4 people out of, you know, could be a dozens or hundreds or whatever it is. And the answer is that we check IOP on everybody, especially kids, we check it on kids, but it's a low yield test. It does not yield a high percentage of disease, but we're still doing it. Well, what if I told you the prevalence of keratoconus in the pediatric population was one in between 300 and 400? And then we ask ourselves, how many of those kids are we scanning with even a topographer, let alone a tomographer, to see if they have a disease? And nobody raises their hands. And so understanding prevalence, if you just look at the raw data, prevalence would tell you that looking for keratoconus with a topographer or tomographer is way more important than checking IOP in terms of trying to uncover the prospect of disease in this kid. However, we have it backwards. Now, I'm not saying to not check pressure on kids. You have to check your eye pressure on kids. But the reality is you're much, much, much more likely to diagnose a kid with keratoconus than you are with glaucoma. But we all do testing for glaucoma, and almost none of us on kids do, you know, more advanced testing for keratoconus. And that's backwards, and that's what we want to fix.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I feel like if I ask a handful of my colleagues, I would get the same response that you did.
Right.
And I know that IKA teamed up with ICO for a study about the prevalence of keratoconus.
Yes.
So if you could talk about that study, how it got started, how did IKA get involved? How were the subjects for the study chosen? That'd be really awesome and interesting.
Awesome. Yeah, no problem. I do want to go back to one thing in talking about prevalence, just because at AOA, one of our most recent guidelines is the second edition of the diabetes guideline for the adult patient. Whether our audience knows this or not, 1 in 10 Americans have diabetes. If you're seeing 30 patients a day, that means 3 of your patients are diabetic. And so when we look at prevalence in that lens, it really changes how we look at every patient walking in. You know, we know obviously over a certain age, there's a higher, you know, over 50, there's a higher, if you have, you know, comorbidities like hypertension and high cholesterol and all those types of things, is increased risk for diabetic retinopathy. But my gosh, 1 in 10 people in the United States having diabetes, and we're frontline doctors, that should be on the front of our head on every single patient that walks in the door. And that's why understanding research and understanding prevalence is so important, because it changes your perspective as a doc about what I should be really looking for in this patient. And I just wanted to say that because it's so, the number is so high, and we are such frontline people with it that you can't ignore the research and you can't ignore these prevalence numbers, which brings me to what you asked about, and I just happen to have it right here. My little paper on the prevalence of keratoconus in the pediatric population. So one of the things that we realized early on, a whole group of us, was that number one, the old data that was being looked at for prevalence of keratoconus, that information dated back to about 1986 in Olmsted County, Minnesota. And the prevalence of the disease that we were all taught to memorize on keratoconus was 1 in 2,000 people. And so very common number, but something that we all memorized for boards. If it was a board question, if you selected 1 in 2,000, you got the right answer, cha-ching, move on to the next question. However, it was so far off, it was crazy. And the reason why is that, like I said before, the corneal topographer was not commercially available until the early 1990s in the United States. This study was done in 1986, and it was done in 3 centers by ophthalmologists only using a retinoscope and looking for scissors motion. And that's how they identified cones. Incredibly antiquated. You know, technically, their devices that they used didn't even plug in, right? So we're not talking about high-tech equipment here. And so because of that, the optometric public, the ophthalmologic public, doesn't think to look for the disease because it's so rare. It's actually at 1 in 2,000, it's actually considered a rare disease in the United States. And so that causes problems. And then, you know, with the advent of LASIK and PRK, and I was a TLC guy, and we had the best time in the world. I got one of the first pentacams in the United States. And we started looking at all these folks that had the disease of keratoconus, and we knew there was a genetic component to it. So one of the things that we did was say, hey, bring in your siblings or your kids so we can look at them and see if they have the disease as well, because maybe we could, you know, at the time, get them into rigid gas permeable lenses, or as, you know, scleral lenses became much more prevalent in terms of use in the community. We can get them into scleral lenses. And then ultimately, with this whole thing about cross-linking was happening, we can start cross-linking off-label in the United States before 2016. And so we started seeing kids come in of parents, and they had keratoconus. And so we said to ourselves, holy cow, what's the prevalence of keratoconus in the pediatric population? And guess what we found?
That it was not 1 in 2,000.
Oh, we'd found no papers on it. And so there was a study in the Middle East, but there were no studies in the United States. And so there was really no established prevalence. People wouldn't know what to look for if you can't establish it. So IKA, one of our core milestones and goals was to actually perform a study looking at the prevalence of keratoconus in the pediatric population. We did it. And the way we did it was, you know, Barry lives in Chicago and he's an adjunct faculty over at ICO. And his good friends, Jen Harthan, who is our first author on the patient, and Sandy Block are both, you know, great professors at ICO. ICO actually has a partnership with the Chicago Public School System. And so what we did, we went through an IRB, we went through parental permissions, we got donated pentacams to bring in, and we actually screened over 4,000 kids in the Chicago Public School System between the ages of 3 and 18 that failed a school screening. So their inclusion criteria was that they had to flunk a vision screening. So that had to be blurry for some reason. We wanted to know why. And this was largely a Black and Hispanic population, largely not financially well off in the area that we looked at. And so these were kids, a lot of these kids did not have access to care and, you know, real other than the ICO Chicago agreement that they had together. That's why ICO was working with them, was to get them care, which is great. And so we screened all these kids that flunked this vision screening and found a prevalence of keratoconus at 1 in 332 kids.
Wow,
with definitive keratoconus. Then, based on the criteria, for those of you who've used a pentacam before, there's this thing called the Bell and Ambrosio display that has software in it that you can actually figure out how severe on a scale these folks are, and also you can put in. You scan the patient, and based on the output from it, if they fall into a certain category, they're considered keratoconus suspects. So when you combine the kids that were suspects plus the kids that were definitively keratoconic, that was a total of about like 1 in 200, 225. And so it's crazy. That's exactly the wow. It's like we were like, wow, this is nuts. Because now you have kids that are coming into these practices that we're working at, all of us, and they have, of the kids that are blurry that would potentially fail a school screening, 1 in 225 of them either have a high suspect for the disease or actually have the disease. And so that means we've got to take care of these kids. And so we've got to get them cross-linking. We've got to get them into contact lenses. We've got to get them on routine follow-ups because we know 10% of their population will decline to need a corneal transplant at some point. And we also know that the earlier a kid gets keratoconus, the higher the likelihood they are to advance at a very rapid rate and decline visually faster and have a higher chance of needing a corneal transplant earlier in their life. And so by sharing all of this information with our colleagues, it was really important. And so that's what this paper is. The title, actually, it's in the March edition of Eye in Contact Lens. Our first author is Jen Harthan, who's the professor of cornea contact lens. She's the chief at ICO. The prevalence of keratoconus based on Scheimpflug corneal tomography metrics in a pediatric population from a Chicago-based school-aged vision clinic. And so what we're trying to do, what our ICO people are trying to do is preach the prevalence, because it's really important for all our fellow eye care providers to understand how prevalent this disease is in this population so they can do something about it.
And to look for it earlier, because I remember in school learning that, we usually diagnose keratoconus in the second or third decade of life, 100%. Not really in the pediatric population. But I also wanted to ask, because I think this applies to a lot of the majority of my colleagues, if I don't have access to a pentacam or tomography in my office, what mm-hmm. risk factors do I look for to know which patients to refer to a practice with a tomographer or a practice that does corneal cross-linking? Is it family history, high astigmatism, unexplained, reduced best corrected visual acuity, or if they're just rubbing their eyes a lot, or do I have to look for that corneal scissoring reflex on retinoscopy?
I mean, look, you did your homework. You know what you're talking about, right? It's all of the above that you just mentioned. But I would say that's really probably the most important thing. Look, I've been sitting here blabbing about all this stuff for the last, 20 minutes or so. If you're going to remember one thing from this whole podcast, other than tune into the upcoming ones, because I know who's coming on and she's got some awesome guests coming up. But if you can remember one thing from this podcast, remember that kids that have keratoconus advance at a much quicker rate than adults. And because of that, you need to bring your kids back sooner for follow-up exams. If I suspect a kid has keratoconus and I'm not 100% sure and I want to follow up and check, I will never let them go more than 6 months. And most likely I'll have them back in 3 months to double check. And what are you looking for? Well, the big signs in that population, obviously, just like everybody else, increase in corneal curvature, because if you don't have a penacam, those corneas can still get steeper. The corneal thickness can change. It's going to get thinner. Also, your magnitude of myopia is going to increase. And that's something that I want to talk about, because there's something that we have to be aware of. Now that we know the prevalence of this disease, somewhere in the 1 in 300 population for kids, 1 in 300, you have a population of kids that have a disease that it makes their corneas look a little steeper, they get more myopic, and they get blurrier. That sounds a lot like myopia, okay? And the problem is that the one thing with this big push to implement myopia management practices in our profession right now, there's a lot of doctors out there that would see an eye getting more myopic and getting a little bit steeper and say, aha, I need to do myopia management. Let's put them in ortho-K lenses, which is going to screw up your corneal curvature for future testing unless the kids are out of their lenses for quite some time. Or they'll put them in atropine or soft spherical multifocal contact lenses. And so what you don't want to do is miss a cone because you're starting them into a myopia management program. Because you'll be sitting there watching the disease get worse right in front of your eyes at these follow-up sequential visits and not intervening when the kid has the best potential vision they'll have for the rest of their life. And so that's the other awareness that we want to bring, is that not all myopes are just myopes. You know, kids who have advancing myopia, you need to rule out whether or not they're positive for corneal ectatic diseases like keratoconus as well.
But what is the youngest age that I can refer a patient to get corneal cross-linking though?
Sure. So corneal cross-linking in the United States today is approved in an epi-off fashion. The device that's approved is a device that's owned by a company called Glaukos, which used to be called Avedro. And the device, in combination with the solution, the riboflavin, is what's approved. It's approved for 14 and above. Okay. However, doctors in the United States, if they feel it's safe and in the best interest of their patients, and because we're talking about a pediatric population, with the permission of the parent, if they go through an informed consent process, of course, you can use it in an off-label fashion below that age. Many, 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 many doctors in the United States are doing that. Many, many doctors. We do a lot of things off-label. Right? All of our antibiotics, if you send a patient in for LASIK or PRK, that patient's walking out with a bottle of, fourth generation fluoroquinolone antibiotics, which is FDA approved for bacterial conjunctivitis, not the prophylactic coverage of a post-surgical cornea. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatories are typically FDA approved for cystoid macular edema, not for pain, right? Generalized pain. And so we do everything all the time in off-label procedures. However, we need to be discussing with our patients that it's off-label and letting them understand, go through that informed consent process with them. There's no different than it is for cross-linking in that younger pediatric population. I will say all of these companies, there are a few companies out now that have devices, and they are all looking to get FDA approval for epithelial on cross-linking, which as an optometrist, I think would be great. I personally think that keratoconus is largely an optometric disease. And what I mean by that is we diagnose these patients. There are patients, we see them come in, they start to progress worse. We diagnose some of their disease. We put them in contact lenses. If we need to, we get them to a doc to get them cross-linked. And what happens after they're cross-linked? They end up back in our offices for more contact lenses. If we can do that cross-linking in our offices, this is a one-stop optometric procedure. And I don't know anything more optometric than, you know, putting some eye drops in an eye and turning on a light switch for the procedure. So I'm hoping that Epion gets approved. And I absolutely hope that all states in the United States have the ability for optometrists to be performing the procedure.
Is corneal cross-linking then, is it covered by insurance? Because I know I'm going to get this question from patients and just other eye care professionals.
Absolutely. So it's, you know, it's really depends. The answer is yes, in some states with certain insurance policies. I wish it was broader. But what I would say is that many, many insurance companies cover it, and but they're probably going to cover it 14 and above if there's a certain amount of progression, which is the way that the FDA clinical trial for the study went. So if you fall into that category, there's a very high likelihood, especially if you have good health insurance with good coverage, that you'll be covered for it. I know that you can go to the Glaukos website. So if you're a doctor and you're like, I don't know, my patient needs to have this covered by insurance, you can go to the website. And again, I don't have any financial affiliation with Glaukos. They're a great company, make a great device. But you can go to their website and it'll tell you who is a approved provider with that device that's FDA approved. And also it has a list of insurances that you can look up to see if your insurance falls into that kind of bucket of being covered or not. Ultimately, the responsibility is up to the patient. You know, you got those cards, you flip it on the back, call that phone number, tell them what diagnosis you have, what the diagnosis code is that you got, and see if they'll cover the procedure for you.
I mean, that's awesome to hear. Going back on something you said before, because I just thought of another question about it. When you mentioned that sometimes keratoconus kind of gets confused with myopia management, I know that most offices, if they don't have access to a topographer or tomographer, they at least have access to an OCT. So would it make sense to do like an ANSEG OCT to kind of measure the thickness of the cornea, do some kind of pachymetry? Like if you already started myopia management and then something's not adding up, they're kind of still progressing, does it make sense to do that test?
Absolutely. You know, with all myopia management, it's not specific to keratoconus, but in my opinion, before you start myopia management, it's a diagnosis of exclusion in that you need to prove that the back of the eye is healthy, right? If the back of the eye is not healthy, there are conditions, there are, you know, staphylomas and other, you know, colobomas in the back of the eye that can obviously, and those are big things, you probably see it pretty easily, but still important to do a comprehensive eye exam on all these kids before you start myopia management and make sure that there's no obvious disease of the eye before you put a patient in a very long-term treatment process. And make sure that if you start myopia management, that you're still doing your annual comprehensive eye exams to make sure you're allowed to be healthy at age 12 and really sick at age 13, right? And if you only have your big eye exam at 12 and nobody's doing a comprehensive eye exam until you're 15 years old, well, you just missed 3 years of disease, right? So it's important to just remember that myopia management isn't the only thing that's going on with the patient when it's happening. And I'm not saying it's not important. It's very important, especially for the right kid. And especially if you do all the testing and it leads you to say, aha, this is an axial length myopia problem that's causing this. Because remember, just because a kid's myopic doesn't mean they need myopia management. The treatments that we use, Ortho-K, atropine, and multifocal soft contact lenses, the way that they work in the myopia management process is they slow the axial length growth of the eye. If you don't have an axial length problem going on that's not getting worse, the treatments that you're using are not going to be effective for what the problem is, right? It's like giving a kid with a virus an antibiotic. It's not going to help the virus, right? So I think that basic remembering of the information of what the treatments are actually doing has to fit the problem that's occurring. And so
finding the underlying cause, right? Because you have to understand why you're doing that treatment.
Yep. Because if you don't find the underlying cause, I promise you somebody at some point will.
Yeah. And speaking of getting for pediatric comprehensive eye exams, currently corneal tomography is not considered the standard of care, but it's important that studies like this get out because I really try to urge eye care professionals to be better than the standard of care, because do what's best for the patient to the best of your knowledge. If you know that posterior changes to the cornea happen, you know, before anterior corneal surface changes and before that visual acuity loss, then that's important for early diagnosis and recognition of progression. So that can lead to earlier intervention, get the patients to someone who does corneal cross-linking, which can halt the disease and therefore bring the patients a higher quality of life.
Ditto. I couldn't have said it any better myself. I mean, that's really what we're looking for at the end of the day. When it all comes down to it, with keratoconus, all the corneal ectatic diseases, these patients are suffering. I don't have keratoconus. I'm not a keratoconic individual, but I have seen thousands of them over the course of my career. And there are 0% of them that wish they can keep their disease. All of them want to get rid of it because it interferes with quality of life. And more importantly, and I think this is a consideration, there is a mental health component that we always have to be aware of when patients have chronic diseases. You know, I hope that you see well with glasses or contact lenses, right? I see well with my glasses and when I wear my contacts. And I can't imagine, and I know what it's like when I have, like, as an optometrist, and I'm sure we're all the same way. If I have like a smudge in the middle of my glasses, like the whole world comes to an end. I need a lens cloth in milliseconds. I cannot live this way. This is terrible. What if your life was like that all the time? You know? If you think about what a keratoconus patient deals with every day, what if you couldn't drive at night because the glare was too much? What if you couldn't see your kid's face clearly and you were a young mom? You know, what if you could barely, what if you were worried every time you went to motor vehicles that you might not pass this time and you got to drive to work every day? You know, that kind of mental anguish that comes with chronic visual disease is unbelievable problem to live with. And I think as eye care professionals, we need to think about that more when we see these patients with chronic disease, because look, our practices are filled with MACD-GEN, diabetic retinopathy, glaucoma, keratoconus, the list goes on. All of them are chronic diseases. All of them are visually disabling. All of them decrease quality of life. I think we always just need to be sympathetic to that with our patients.
Right. And like I said, when you do better than the standard of care to the best of your knowledge, you're actually looking for those gaps and seeing this is what drives our profession to be better. Empathize with the patients. Like exactly what you said, what if you couldn't drive at night? What if you couldn't see your child's face? You would want whoever is treating you and who is seeing you to do the best that they can to their knowledge.
Absolutely. 100%.
So speaking of your work, tell us about working at Walter Reed. What's that like?
It's awesome. You know, we work with it's the greatest people on planet Earth. I can't say it any other way. They're grateful. They are hardworking. They don't give up. And good news, they all show up for their appointments on time, which is really nice. But I will say the population is great. And, you know, you see bad stuff just like, you know, you do at other hospitals. Sometimes our bad stuff is different than other bad stuff. Okay. What I will say is that to narrow that focus down to the, because I think it's important, I am not in the military. I am a contractor. I consider myself a guest at Walter Reed, trying to do the best that I can. There are folks, optometrists specifically, since we're going to get a lot of optometrists on this call, we'll talk about them, that are in uniform that work so hard. What I will tell you is that when you are at a meeting and you see an optometrist in a uniform, just say thanks. And because they are working harder than you think they are. It's a wonderful population of people here. It really is.
Definitely. How did you get into working then for the military and becoming a government contractor?
Great question. So for me, it was, believe it or not, I did a lot of stuff before I got here. I did a lot of research. I worked on a lot of studies. You know, I worked at TLC and did a lot of lecturing through them. And I was on faculty at a couple of ophthalmology and optometry schools. And really, my story is I kept a really strong CV and kept it out there. And really, one day I got a phone call because, you know, luck is part luck and part being in the right place at the right time, and part doing a lot of hard work to get yourself ready for when luck comes your way. And I worked really hard to, you know, to advance my career and try to do as many things as I could. And I was contacted by a bunch of different contractors that were trying to fill this role. And it was just, you know, a normal interview process where I kept on interviewing and interviewing and interviewing. I will say, when I was younger, the idea of working with the military was always something that I wanted to do. The opportunity came about and I was like, you know what? Let's give it a shot. You know, I can always, I hate to say this, but I can always go be an optometrist, you know, at an optometric clinic, as many of us are. But it'll be rare for me to have an opportunity to work on a military base with this population of people. And it's new and it's interesting. And I didn't know what I was getting into at the time, but it turns out that I enjoy my job to the, you know, nth degree. I really enjoy coming to work every day. I work with great people and we have a great mission and we try to do the right thing. And it's created opportunities for me, but more than anything else, I can't stress enough how great it is to work with colleagues that are this caliber and this quality every day, because I'm not 25 anymore and I've been out of school for a couple of weeks and I'm still learning so much every single day that I'm here. But we also get optometric externs that are here in the clinic, and I get to work with some optometric externs, and the staff that's here is great. And I just can't say enough great things about it. It's a hard job and it's harder for the people in uniform, but I will say that it's incredibly rewarding, and it gives you a really great sense of, you know, personal value when you're doing this type of stuff.
Right. And you don't know how much you like something or if it's not a good fit for you until you try it. So there's always an importance in networking. And like you said, when people were coming up to you with giving you this opportunity to be a contractor, it's not only about who you know, it's about who knows you as well. And keeping your CV up to date, lecturing, getting your name out there about what you like to do, and those opportunities will definitely come up for you.
Yeah. I got to say, I got to flip this interview around for a second, just so your audience can hear this. So we, you know, obviously, you know, we've known each other for a little while before, but we never really got to sit down and chat together. And I will tell you that it was so refreshing to talk to you about, and I know many other people out there work this hard, but how hard you are actually working to live the life that you do, you know, to say, hey, I want to live this life over here, but it's going to take a hell of a lot of work over here to get over to that place. And to hear what you were doing and how you were explaining it to me was really refreshing. And just to see the excitement that you have for the profession and what you want to do and what you want to build. And most importantly, and I firmly believe this about you, that I know for a fact that zero things will get in your way that are going to stop you. And I think that is really commendable, because I know you'll go places, and I'm sure there's plenty of other folks out there that are the same way, but I can't tell you how refreshing it is to see younger people in our profession have the level of excitement that you have and the kick the door down mentality that you have. It was a great dinner that night.
Thank you so much for those kind words. I think the thing is that I found something that really motivated me. So mm-hmm. I wanted to see if I can pull it off, doing the whole traveling for 6 months and working. And I knew that I had to work really, really hard during the few months that I was in New York, like the 2 months mm-hmm. that I was in New York City going to all these clinics, because it's worth it. And then basically putting myself through that, I realized that if I can do this, I can take on so much more. You just have to find the right motivation, because that's really everything. Like, what's your purpose? What's your motivation? What inspires you? And I just want to share that with other people, because I see all these posts, you know, on like the Facebook groups and the young OD groups, of everyone asking what the norm is for like their 9-to-5 job. And Why do you compare what everyone else's norm is and what everyone likes, essentially, about, but find what motivates you is what I'm saying. And then go with that, because everything is going to be individualized to every single optometrist. So I was really lucky that I kind of met the right people at a school who taught me that, and I was able to do that. So I want to share it with others.
Yeah, I can't tell you how important networking has been to my career. I absolutely have mentors, no doubt about it, in this profession. People that I still count on as mentors, that I still talk to about work all the time. And they know who they are, obviously. And so obviously trying to give that back to a younger optometrist as well is really important, because nobody gets to any, you know, you see all these folks out there that are lecturing all over the place that are very well-known optometrists. Zero of them got there alone. Nobody did. And so I think it's important to recognize the kind of kinship that there is within optometry. And, you know, if you get it when you're younger, you got to give it back when you're older. And so I will also say, you know, going to meetings, not that, because I'm, you know, I am shamelessly promoting my meeting, the IKA Keratoconus Symposium. It's May 18th and 19th in Bethesda, Maryland. We're all over the internet. You can find us. But it's not just my meeting. It's the AOA. It's the Academy. It's, you know, the expo meetings and even the smaller meetings. Meeting people in the eye care profession. And it's not just other optometrists. It could be other ophthalmologists. People in industry. Getting down and talking to people is really, really important. You know, I always stress to my students, some of the most important people, when you're opening up a new practice, some of the most important people that you're going to be able to meet and talk to are reps, because they're in everybody else's office in the area and they know what's going on everywhere. And so they can tell you what trends are going on and all that type of stuff. So I think that open communication, getting to meetings, I can't tell you the networking available is, like, we met at a meeting, you know, it's incredibly important. It, you know, this opportunity right here that everybody is looking at is the offspring from having a meeting together and talking about what we do for work. And so, yeah, it's very important to your profession.
Right. And I will say that every single person that I ever came up to in the field of optometry, whether it was another optometrist, someone in industry, ophthalmologist, and I just came up to them, introduced myself, and said I was interested in learning about them and their career path and their work, and if they researched something. No one has ever turned down the opportunity to connect, which I think is maybe it's a misconception. Maybe it's something that's intimidating for younger optometrists, but no one's going to turn you down. Just reach out, shoot them an email, come up to them at a meeting, introduce yourself. Get out there. And that's how you make the connections, by showing up and taking the initiative to introduce yourself.
You're 100% right. I can't argue with you at all. And, you know, you're going to want to build not just a practice, not just an office, not just a career, but you can build this life in optometry. And, you know, having as many advocates on your side is the way to do it.
Absolutely. Well, this has been really, really awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, provide listeners with this awesome insight, and really expand on the work you've done with the research and the prevalence of keratoconus and the IKA symposium that's coming up. I feel like I really learned a lot about how to diagnose and where and when to refer if I suspect keratoconus, especially in my pediatric patients. So thank you so much for that.
It's a good way to, you know, it's a great segue for younger docs that are, you know, like yourself, opening a practice. Call up, you know, get into a pediatrician's office, talk to a pediatrician, be like, hey, like, here's this paper, this is the study. If you have patients that are seeing blurry, we have to make sure that this disease is not taking place. Refer them into my practice so I can get a good look at them. All these things are really great opportunities for networking and practice building.
Yeah, absolutely. Get out there, network within your community as well. Like you mentioned, pediatricians, other doctors' offices, I know like most communities have on Facebook, like their groups, like that area, you know, moms and parents groups. But yeah, education is key. I feel like dentists do a really good job of educating, of like getting a, you know, cleaning every 6 months. But I think optometrists as a community, we have to do a better job of just educating the general public. Like, it's great to educate other ODs, but don't forget about the actual patients that need to know as well.
I can't say it any better than you said it already. It's a great profession. Kick some doors down, and there's no straight path to getting to the end of optometry.
Thank you so much.